Good evening, everyone. Tonight I want to speak about a word that I have quite recently become aware of, even though it appears very frequently in the Pali scriptures, the scriptures of Theravada Buddhism I mentioned before, the Tipitaka, it's also called. So this word is appamada, appamada, and it has many different translations in English, and that's probably why it's not well known or widely used, even though it is a very, very important word for the deepening of our practice. We use many other Pali words like Dhamma, Dukkha, Nicca, and so on, without the need to always translate them, because many people know what they mean already. So how many of you know the meaning of Dhamma? So, yeah, quite a few. Dukkha? You should know by now. Anicca? Yeah, appamada. I didn't know until about a few months ago, actually, when a friend of mine in Stockholm happened to mention that he had come across this word. So the basic meaning of appamada is carefulness. To take care concerning everything we do, actually. And to take care has this feeling of compassion and kindness to it. And it also has an aesthetic sort of ring. When you take care of something, when you're careful, you're not sloppy, throwing garbage all around you and things like that. You walk on the earth in beauty, like there is an American Indian saying that you should walk on the earth in beauty. And I think appamada has that, also that sort of meaning. But it's also very often translated as heedfulness, diligence, vigilance, and concern. But these translations don't really capture the spirit of appamada, of care. I think they're too strong and almost militaristic in their... It's more... diligence, you know, it's more forceful than care. So, and also this word appamada is a negation of pamada, which means to be negligent, careless, lax, or lazy. And this prefix up makes it into the opposite of all these unwholesome states of mind. So actually it means non-carelessness. And this is very typical of Pali language, that it uses one word and then it puts some prefix and it becomes a non-dose, that word. Like it's like with the what we call the root poisons, greed, hate and ignorance. What you should develop is non-greed, non-hatred and non-ignorance. So that's the same way of actually saying, even if you mean generosity, kindness and wisdom, it's the same. It's expressed as non-greed, non-hatred and non-delusion. So that's just a thing about Pali. So there is a sutta, a speech by the Buddha called the Appamada Sutta, and it's found in Anguttara Nikaya, which is a part of the Pali Canon. And this story is set in Savatthi, the capital of the kingdom of Kosala. And the Buddha spent a lot of time there, especially when he was getting older. And that was because there was the Yatavana Grove and Monastery outside the city, and that was donated to the Buddha by his lay disciple Anattapindika, who was a very rich merchant. So Anattapindika bought the land from the prince of Kosala, and his name was Yeta, and that's why it's called Yetavana Grove. And Yeta wanted, the payment was that he would cover the ground, the whole ground of that area, with gold coins. So Anattapindika was rich enough to do this, so he sent for this wagon load of coins, and his servants and him, they covered the ground with these coins. But then there was a piece left near the sort of entrance to this park, and Anattapindika said to Jeta, the prince, that, okay, I send for more coins. But then the prince, who actually didn't want to sell the land at first, that's why he came up with this thing about the gold coins, he then was so impressed by and inspired by Anattapindika's appamada, his carefulness and earnestness. So he said that he would donate this piece of land for free if he could build the entrance gate, which he did, and it was a very, very beautiful, elaborate entrance gate. So he spent all the money, all the coins that Anattapindika had put on the ground, the prince spent on this fantastic entrance gate. And then Anattapindika, he built a large monastery there, and the ruins of it can still be seen in Savatthi. Is now called Shravasti, but it's still there in northern India, and you can still see ruins there. So anyway, back to this Appamada Sutta itself. So it starts with this conversation between the Buddha and the king Pasenadi of Kosala. So this is what it says. As he was sitting to one side, King Pasenadi said to the Blessed One is Buddha, "Is there, Lord, any one quality that keeps both kinds of benefits secure, benefits in this life and benefits in lives to come?" And the Buddha answered, "There is one quality, great king, that keeps both kinds of benefits secure, benefits in this life and benefits in lives to come. But what, Lord, is that one quality?" "Carefulness, great king. To the extent that there are living beings, footless, two-footed, four-footed, many-footed, with form or formless, percipient or non-percipient, the Tathagata, worthy and rightly self-awakened, is the foremost among them." So Tathagata is referring to the Buddha. Greg mentioned that before. That's the term he always used when talking about himself. So I will read this again, but without all these feet, because otherwise you don't get the sort of coherent meaning of it. There was a lot of feet there. So, "Carefulness, great king, to the extent that there are living beings, the Tathagata, worthy and rightly self-awakened, is the foremost among them. In the same way, all skillful qualities are rooted in carefulness, converge in carefulness, and carefulness is reckoned the foremost among them. And he goes on to say, just as the footprints of all walking beings can be encompassed by the footprint of the elephant, and the elephant's footprint is declared to be supreme among them in terms of its great size. In the same way, all skillful qualities are rooted in carefulness, converged in carefulness, and carefulness is reckoned the foremost among them. So these are the two first verses of the Appamada Sutta. And then it goes on with eight more verses in the same repetitive style, which is typical for most suttas, because they weren't written down until 300-400 years after the death of the Buddha, so they were kept alive orally. People were learning them by heart or chanting them, and then this repetitive style was easy for people to remember. But anyway, I want to read two more of these verses because they're beautiful poetry actually, and they're all comparing the greatness of certain natural phenomena to the greatness of carefulness. So here are the two last verses of this sutta. Just as in the last months of the rains in autumn, when the sky is clear and cloudless, the sun, on ascending the sky, overpowers the space immersed in darkness. It shines, blazes, and dazzles. In the same way, all skillful qualities are rooted in carefulness, converge in carefulness, and carefulness is reckoned the foremost among them. Just as the great rivers, such as Ganga, the Jamuna, and the Narmada, all go to the ocean, incline to the ocean, slope to the ocean, tend towards the ocean, and the ocean is reckoned the foremost among them. In the same way, all skillful qualities are rooted in carefulness, converged in carefulness, and carefulness is reckoned the foremost among them. So this is what the Blessed One said. And as I said in the beginning, I didn't know about Appamada until recently. But the more I was thinking and pondering about it, the more interesting it became. Because I saw how useful it is, both in formal meditation practice and in our daily life. It kind of amplifies and strengthens all other wholesome qualities of mind. So I really feel that it's a true refuge, like the title of the retreat is about all these different true refuges that we can find, and Appamada is definitely one of them. In the Dhammapada, which is another small scripture that is attributed to the Buddha, there are also some verses about Appamada. So here are two of them. Clearly understanding the excellence of carefulness, the wise rejoice therein and enjoy the resort of the noble ones. The wise ones, ever meditative and carefully persevering, alone experience Nibbana, the incomparable freedom from bondage. So it's a big thing. So, what other skillful or wholesome qualities do we have that are rooted in apamada, converged in apamada, and so on, like the sutta said? Well, first of course comes mindfulness, sati, which is what we are practicing here, and that's to remember to be present in the moment, to directly observe what's happening in the mind and the body and the surroundings. So it means to be awake and not, as we often are, going on automatic pilot, doing things while our thoughts, our mind is somewhere else. And mindfulness also includes a wish to remain sort of neutral to what we are experiencing, not to judge or condemn ourselves or others from our preconceptions, but to try to see things with fresh eyes, almost like we were kids and saw them for the first time. If we're fully present and open in this way, our everyday experience becomes much more interesting and more lively than if we go through life half asleep. And mindfulness together with apamada feels even more caring and kind, more relaxed in a way, careful mindfulness. There are two other qualities of mind that come together with mindfulness. And the first one is atapi, which means enthusiasm or eagerness or, you know, interest. And sampajayana, clear comprehension. And sampajayana is usually described as an overall knowledge about where we are and what we are doing right now. It's very useful in daily life, for example, when there is no time to really go into detail of little sensations here and there. So then we can just have this clear comprehension to know where we are and what we are doing, and a sort of overview. And adding apamada, you get caring enthusiasm, or caring comprehension, which also feels sort of a bit less self-centered and more open to the feel of it. Another skillful quality is effort, virya. But effort is sometimes mixed up with striving, impatience, a sort of leaning forward, wanting results, and so on. But effort in Vipassana context is simply means to have the intention and willingness to pay attention here and now to what's happening. So it doesn't mean that we need to change what we experience or improve ourselves, but simply and steadily observe what is really happening without illusions and self-deceptions. So this careful or caring effort feels more softer and gentler and less harsh on ourselves. So apamada with effort is also a very good combination. The next wholesome mind state is investigation, dhamma vichaya, and that means to have an investigative and curious attitude of mind, to sort of be open to discover new things. And sometimes when our meditation practice maybe starts feeling a little routine and unengaged and boring, that can depend on that we don't really look deeply at what is happening in body and mind. We stay at some comfortable level of sort of daydreaming or tranquility or whatever it is, and we don't make the careful effort to go any deeper. So that's when we need to remember this factor of investigation. And investigation in this case is not only intellectual, although it is possible to investigate something also by thinking about it. Sometimes that's necessary. But in Vipassana meditation, it often means a direct and intuitive experience and perception of body and mind. So on the physical level, one can, for example, examine exactly how it feels when you breathe, for example. All these subtle vibrations at the nose or the rising and falling. You can discover many little subtle things when the abdomen rises and falls and causes all these different sensations that we usually don't see or feel. You know, it's just breathing and this to investigate these kind of things might seem a bit strange thing to do. What's it good for? But it can actually prove to be very interesting, and it's also sharpening our mindfulness and our concentration. So on the mental plane, investigation means that we're also aware of our thoughts, feelings, and consciousness, awareness itself. So when we get a bit more concentrated, we can actually explore moment by moment of mental activity, how the mind recognizes an object and sees this object change and maybe disappear or get stronger or whatever happens to it. And we can see how different patterns of our life, for example, fear or identification with things, how it's repeated and how they affect us and our relationship with ourselves, our family, work, and all other parts of our lives. So this investigating attitude that the Buddha recommends also fits well with appamada, careful and caring investigation of body, mind, and the world around us is really important if we want to understand who we are and our relation to other sentient beings and to nature itself. Investigation in the sort of scientific sense and in the scientific world can sometimes be very non-caring and not like, for example, when different products are tested on animals. That's no appamada there. That's not caring about nature and other sentient beings. So that's the sort of difference between this investigation in this Buddhist sense and maybe scientific investigation. So another of these mind states that is needed is courage, careful courage to explore all these things, nooks and crannies of our mind as our meditation practice deepens, it's not at all certain that there is only peace and happiness we see. And there may be stages that are painful and difficult, and doubt, despair, anger, fear are all these emotions that we also need to explore, as well as happiness and serenity. As Greg said yesterday, I think, you cannot understand or escape dukkha if you don't first get to know it properly. So, investigation is also about that, getting to know dukkha. John of the Cross, a Christian mystic, speaks of the dark night of the soul, and in his Christian version, it's a stage on the spiritual path that the seeker has to work through before they can understand God. And there is a similar thing also in Buddhism. It's called the Dukkha Jnanas, and it's necessary to have careful courage and perseverance to explore this path, because you have to open up for both deep pain and deep happiness. So, just a little warning, or whatever. But, I mean, sometimes I was under the impression for a long time that my meditation practice would just be better and better and better and better, and I would be happier and happier and happier. But I realized that wasn't the case. There was a lot more to this path. So, after all this talk about this, about suffering and dukkha and dark nights of the soul, one can believe that the meditation is a very gloomy undertaking. But luckily, it's not so, because there's also joy, rapture, happiness, delight, and even ecstasy. So these joyful mind states are called piti in Pali. And it can take many different forms, manifest itself in many different ways. It might be just a mild feeling of being happy with the life right now, being satisfied, to be light-hearted, to not to take everything so terribly serious. That's also an aspect of piti. Sometimes we get very overwhelmed with all our problems, real or imagined. Our life dramas seem very solid and important, and we are fully identified with them. That's when you need this quality of caring lightness and humor to get some perspective and realize that everything passes, everything changes. And no mind state lasts forever, even if it feels so sometimes. Another way that this piti can manifest itself when we come to deeper states of concentration in meditation, there can be thrills in the body, and one can get sort of goosebumps or tingling sensations for no reason at all. Or some people can see colors or flashes of light behind closed eyes. Sometimes the body can feel very light, almost floating freely in space. And the meditation can feel very good, and time passes very quickly. So this kind of joy, which is developed through meditation, is different from the joy that is experienced in worldly life. It has its cause in the mind that is collected and focused on the present moment, And that moment is also free from desire, hatred, tiredness, restlessness and doubt, which we call the five hindrances that Greg talked about this morning. But actually, all these pleasant and sometimes very spectacular things that you can have in your meditation, they don't really mean anything. That's the mistake we make very often. We think that is, that means something fantastic. But they don't really mean much, except they're just byproducts of concentration, a concentrated mind. And concentration is the next wholesome mind state, concentration or samadhi, which, as I said, means that the mind is gathered and focused on an object. Just as light can be concentrated into laser beams and it can cut through steel, the concentrated mind can penetrate deep into the processes of life. It can observe things that an unconcentrated and wandering mind can't, is not able to do. And this is what the Buddha's mind was like. That's why he could penetrate into, I mean, there's so many discoveries that he made about the human mind that is quite amazing when you read the scriptures. So when you begin to meditate and turn your attention inward, the first thing you usually see is how uncontrollable the mental and emotional processes are. You may have thought that you decide what to think and feel, but it turns out that we have very little control over this stream of thoughts, feelings, reactions that constantly flow through our minds. But when our minds become a bit more focused and still, we can start to explore these different layers of thoughts and feelings and see how they appear and disappear like soap bubbles in every moment. And the body that seemed so solid consists of all these moving sensations, and we see that everything is a process of constant change. So in this way, concentration helps us to develop wisdom and understanding of how things work, what is the true nature of things. So careful concentration is also very useful in everyday life. One becomes more efficient and integrated, and with this caring attitude of appamada, concentration gives rise to the next wholesome mind state, which is calm. Calm, peace, tranquility. It's in Pali, pasadi. And to feel calm and serene is a very pleasant mental state, which actually also can be practiced. Because body and mind are so intimately connected with each other, we can sometimes help to calm the mind by calming the body. Like, for example, to sit as still as possible when meditating can help calming the mind. Also, in the Satipatthana Sutta, there is a part where you can, with your breathing, calm the mind. And that, it's really, yeah, it works quite well. You can just think calm, or say to yourself, I'm calming the mind with the breath. you have to read about that. That was something I added right now. So, breathing deeply and slowly for a little while, if you feel upset or frustrated, can also be very calming, because you can notice that breathing very often becomes very short and shallow when you're agitated or anxious or angry or something. So then a few deep breaths can help to bring more calm. And there are many ways of getting calm also in daily life, like walking in the woods or walking in nature, spending time in nature alone or with a friend, listening to the wind or the waves, the rustling of the leaves. It's also very calming and healing. So it's probably no coincidence that the Buddha chose to stay in the woods with his monks and nuns. He always said that here there are trees and roots of trees. Here we can meditate. So he stayed rather in the small places and nature than in some noisy city. A great calm may also appear when we drop our efforts to control and manage everything. When we accept that others may have a different way of doing things, and that way can also work or not. Neither ourselves nor others are always perfect. And it's very exhausting to be irritated about all these little things that we don't like. Thich Nhat Hanh, the Vietnamese Zen master and poet, he recommends that we should smile a little to ourselves when we meditate. Just a little smile starts the endorphins going, and we can feel a bit better. So tolerance and humor and a little smile is really good for our inner peace and our meditation practice. And calm, together with appamada, makes it easier to stay focused and not drift away in these pleasant daydreams, which can also easily happen when the mind is in this pleasant, calm mind state. It's very easy then to sort of flip over into daydreaming or sleepiness. So then carefulness, appamada, can make the difference. So the skillful and wholesome mind states that I've mentioned so far, that we can all experience, they all belong to one of the Buddha's lists, the seven factors of enlightenment, it's called. So it's when we have developed these factors to a certain extent, we can then truly wake up from this dream of samsara. So the last of them is equanimity, upekkha. So is it possible to have careful equanimity? Yeah, why not? Equanimity means to be able to meet all of life's ups and downs with an inner balance. In our lives, there's always situations that we can't avoid or change. There is nobody who does not at some time suffer from grief, accidents, sickness, or pain, loss in some way. So the question is how we can open ourselves and live with the inevitable when it hits us. to become totally paralyzed or heartbroken will do no good in the long run, but even sorrow must take its time to heal. It's a process. But and in this process we can have use of our meditation practice. It's a way to take this theoretical part into reality, to take meditation from the cushion and out into the world and use it there. So equanimity develops as we learn by and by to not to be totally overwhelmed by our emotions. But it's very important not to confuse equanimity with indifference, which is the so-called near enemy of equanimity. So it's a mental state that on the surface is similar to equanimity, but in reality it's quite different. Indifference means that we have turned off our emotions, we don't allow ourselves to be touched, we become emotionally numb or jaded and we don't care. And we don't care about our life or the welfare of sentient beings or nature. But with equanimity we develop from this careful observation and wisdom. One definition of equanimity is to be equally close to all things. So that means that we are still open and feeling and equally close to all things. So that's also what Appamada is about, to be careful and caring in all our speech and actions in life. When are we supposed to finish?
Around 8:15.
Oh, 8:15. Okay. I'll tell you this little Zen story. I don't know, maybe if you any of you have heard it before. It's kind of old, but I like it. So there is this Zen story that illustrates equanimity in a very radical way. So long ago in Japan, there was this local warlords who terrorized people in the neighboring states. And one of these guys were especially known for his cruelty and his rage. So the inhabitants of the village heard that he and his army was approaching. They all fled up into the mountains. Only one person remained, and that was the Zen master. He stayed in his temple. So these warlords' troops invaded this village, and the soldiers told the commander that it was empty of inhabitants except for a monk that sat meditating in the temple. So the commander strode off to the temple, threw open the door and stood in front of the Zen master with his sword raised and shouted, "Why are you sitting here? Why have you not fled with the others? Don't you know that I am a man that who can cut you in half without blinking?" And then the Zen master calmly met his eyes and replied, "But I am a man who can be cut in half without blinking." So it is said that this the warlord lowered his sword, bowed and left. So, that was equanimity. But to develop wholesome mind states includes also to develop metta, usually translated as loving kindness. But with the aspect of apamada, it could also be called caring kindness. Not loving kindness, caring kindness. I think that's a much better translation, actually, since the word love has so many other connotations. Also, karuna, compassion, that we have talked quite a lot about, could be caring compassion. I think this caring apamada adds a new dimension to all these wholesome states of mind. In the Parinibbana Sutta, which describes the time around the death of the Buddha, it's said that his last words to the monks, nuns, and lay people that were gathered there, where he in Kusinara, the village where he was lying on his deathbed, and his last words were in Pali, Vaya Dhamma Sankara Appamadema Sampadetati, which means, all compounded things are impermanent. Go on practicing with carefulness. So the fact that the Buddha used the word appamada in his very last words shows how important it is to be careful and to take care of our body and mind and also of our planet, animals and nature. And so I found this citation by Stephen Batchelor. Appamada is more than just a meditative state of mind. It's more than just being mindful. It has to do with that primary ethical or moral orientation we have in life, which we bring into being whatever activity we are engaged in, whether in formal meditation, in our interactions with other people, in our social concerns, or in our political choices. It's the energetic cherishing of what we regard as good. So I think that's a very good sort of definition of one aspect of appamada, that it's both ethical and moral, and we can use it in every situation in life. Because carefulness acts like a protective circle around all the other wholesome and skillful feelings and mind states. Like it says in the Appamada Sutta, just as the footprints of all walking beings can be encompassed by the footprint of the elephant, and the elephant's footprint is declared to be supreme among them in terms of its great size, in the same way, all skillful qualities are rooted in carefulness, converge in carefulness, and carefulness is reckoned the foremost among them. So, should we, as tradition is, sit just a few seconds and let these words sink in or fly out through the window, whatever you prefer.